Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders Live. In this podcast, I ask a special guest to select and talk about the seven wonders of his or her world. This episode is one of several we recorded in front of a live audience at the 2022 Edinburgh Festival Fringe. And the guest who joined me for this recording is a stage and screen actor who, depending on your TV viewing habits, you might know from Cold Feet, Downton Abbey, Joking Apart, My Family, or Wild at Heart. So here we are with an enthusiastic Edinburgh Fringe audience exploring the seven wonders of Robert Bathurst.
Good to see you. Good to see you, Robert. Now, depending on people's TV viewing habits, they might know you from all sorts of things, like Cold Feet.
Yes,
you like that. Well, we could do with some Cold Feet this summer, couldn't we? Of course, Downton Abbey, you played a rather nasty character in Downton Abbey.
I left Lady Edith at the altar.
Yes.
Ooh.
Oh, boo. You've lost the crowd already.
Yeah.
But that's when I had to mug up on how many things I thought that, you know, you did one or two things, but there's dozens of things you've been doing, quite extraordinary.
Yeah, actually, I got two things in my CV which I've made up. With two shows, and somebody stopped me ages ago on the tube in Brixton, and said, and I've used this ever since in my theatre bugs. He said, you're on the telly, aren't you? And I said yes. So. And then she got off, and they came back on again. So my friend wants to know what you've been in.
Yeah.
And I didn't have my CV on me, so I said, oh, just, you know, The Odd Thing. And she called down the platform, he was in The Odd Thing. And I've used that ever since in my theatre bio, TV also included. Yeah. But also added another made-up title for a catch-all for all the episodes of crap I've done over the years, and things, well, things I don't sort of own up to.
Yes.
Which comes in as I call it, loads of tosh. And so when Cold Feet did a brochure, a publicity brochure, and underneath my photograph, it said, star of TV's The Odd Thing and loads of tosh. But I can't think of an actor who hasn't been in loads of tosh.
Yeah.
Anyway,
you're in Joking Apart. Not that was a load of God. Was that your first big TV thing, Joking
first
Apart?
There was a Stephen Moffat sitcom about his divorce, which we made two series over a 4-year, in the early 90s. People still remember it, I think. I mean, people stopped me in public transport and asked me to give the details of their favourite episode. You know, I adored that one. Yeah,
are people always stopping you on public transport? You're going around. Hello, I'm an actor.
Exactly, that's true. Yeah, there seems to be a theme running, but there,
Before we get on with your wonders, the other interesting thing about you, come across, if I may say so, what's the epitome of an Englishman, which is, this is maybe not the place to do it, but but before you lived in England, you lived first in Ghana or Gold Coast as it was way back then, and Ireland.
I grew up in Ireland. Yeah.
So, do we detect any Ghanaian aspects in you or Irish bits?
No, Irish tastes. I mean, I left when I was 10. I mean, I don't. I didn't come to England until I was 10. Ireland was very formative. I mean, I left Africa when I was two, so I had no.
All right. Yeah. Okay. But, all right. Now we met. I directed you in a review a long while ago. Yeah. I suspect you've had better directors since then. But you haven't really gone down that route of being in sort of sketch comedy or stand-up comedy. Although Joking Apart was about
Joking Apart was about someone. Stephen wrote it about himself, about someone who can never confront anything seriously, always talked in one-liners and so forth. In fact, I lost the third series because of a one-liner. We did two series. We did the second series. And and we had the Christmas party, 1993, BBC Two Christmas party, and the head of BBC Two, you probably knew him, I lined up, and I'd had a couple.
Yes.
All right. And
do we need to know his name?
Michael Jackson.
Oh, Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
There are lots of Michael Jackson.
There are loads of them.
The head of the army was Michael Jackson.
He was, yeah. Sir Michael Jackson. Yeah. Wasn't he? Yeah. I just hopeless with executives. I've lost so many things just talking to TV executives. You'd never. And so the lineup, the royal lineup with Michael Jackson. He said, "Okay, right, we've done series. Just done series two of Joking Apart, which was fantastic. It was brilliantly written. It was brilliant stuff. Good, great stuff.
Well performed."
And anyway, so we said, "Okay, so we got we just done series two, and we'll put out series one, and we'll put out series two together. We put all 12 episodes together, and then we'll make series three in the spring." Yeah. And to which the answer should have been, "Michael, that's fantastic. Yes. I mean, I think that's a really, really good idea." Because he then drew a little sort of media graph, and he said, "We want the viewing figures," he said, "to go like Everest." Yeah. And all I said was, "Yeah, but Everest goes down the other side."
That's not a...
And he cut me, so went on to the next person like that. And we never made series three. Oh. And Stephen Moffat said, "Well, at least we went out in a one-liner."
Yeah. That's not the worst thing you could have said.
I know. I thought it was, severe.
Meetings with controllers.
Kowtowing, yes. Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah.
I remember I was a slightly different thing. I'd made two documentary series, and there was a different head of BBC Two by then, and they were changing jobs rapidly. Michael Jackson kept getting a new job. Yeah. And they couldn't make a decision about the third series, which was very time-consuming for me. And I tactically did the wrong thing, because I demanded a meeting with the controller, and I found myself saying, like, "Well, all I need is an answer, yes or no."
Oh, leading with the chin.
Yes.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Now, is anybody seeking advice on how to manage your career? There is only one answer at that point.
Oh, God.
Okay, let's start with your wonders. And I've got them in front of you, in front of me, so you don't have to worry about them. But the first one you put on your list is an interesting one. Starts good and then goes, I don't know. Number one, World Heritage Sites, when I have them to myself.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, have you been to the Parthenon in the crowds? I mean, when people are... It's a purely selfish thing, this, but I have had the opportunity occasionally of being at World Heritage Sites and had them to myself. Yeah. And it makes such a difference. Yes. I was in the Parthenon last summer, and it was just so crowded. I 81, I was traveling in Turkey. Midnight Express had just been out about 3 or 4 years or something. There were no tourists around, and I was with three other people. And we had Ephesus entirely to ourselves, hotels. And it was just the most fantastic. I was able to try out you're not allowed to climb on it now anyway, though, the big amphitheater. I tried out the acoustic on that.
Oh, right.
And
yes.
And it's just such a treat when there aren't crowds, when there aren't
Well, you are sitting in a World Heritage Site, of course, because the old and new town of Edinburgh is a World Heritage Site.
Right.
And you haven't got it to yourself.
I haven't got it to myself. Otherwise, I'd be doing the show on my own, wouldn't I?
No crowds at all.
But it is a thrill when you crowd. I mean, we're queuing up to see the Alhambra in Granada, and the Henry Elife Gardens are just there, and there was a gate open, and the gardens weren't open, and nothing was open then, but we slipped in through the gate, and so we had the Henry Elife Gardens to ourselves, right, 20 minutes until we got chucked out.
All right.
And it was brilliant. And likewise, on honeymoon, we went to Tikal in Guatemala. And again, there'd been some civil unrest or something. And so we were also on our own, pretty much. Mm. And in the Mayan ruins, in the jungle, these huge, great sort of structures erupting out of the jungle. And again, we had it to ourselves. And there is something, a real thrill about these
places. So have you worked out a way of achieving this, like sort of getting a travel agent, if such things still exist, to check out somewhere? Right, as soon as there's a disaster or a plague or something, we'll go there then.
Just use a neutron bomb or something like that. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I can see the joy of going to see.
Well, the pleasure of just having it. It's a real privilege. I mean, you stumble on it and just relish it when it's happening, because it's quite rare.
But it sounds like you travel a lot to lots
I'd
of lovely places.
To various places. But
All right. Well, that's a link with the sort of pre-existing list of wonders, but you're with your slightly misanthropic take on it.
Yeah, entirely.
Yeah, that's for an actor not to like people is a bit odd, but there it is. they're always going to come up and make you make up another TV program you've been in. So, but your next wonder is baseball. Now, I wouldn't have predicted baseball for you. Do you play
it? Well, I have the fervor of a convert, really, with baseball. And I would say I'd probably narrow the, and I don't know if this means anything to anybody here, but I would probably narrow my wonder of the world down to a double play. That doesn't mean anything to anyone. No.
Well, you're in a double play.
But baseball. I was doing King Charles III in Chicago, and everyone was mad keen on baseball, and it was intriguing because you see there, unlike in other parts that I'm more familiar with, how high art and sport are completely intermeshed. Yeah. And I went along to a Poetry Foundation evening when I was rehearsing, and I went along one evening to the Chicago Poetry Foundation. They had a very serious evening of Pablo Neruda, and it was translations. Yes. And it was a time when the Cubs up the road at the Wrigley Field were playing Los Angeles Dodgers in some big playoff. And
these are all baseball terms. We're all familiar with, I'm hoping, otherwise.
And the meeting finished, and it was all very, very good. And the organizer said, and I'd like to next week we will meet at the Furniture Foundation, and we'll be meeting this, and I shall leave you with the words, "Go Cubs!" and I just thought it was just fantastic. You know, all these sort of serious poetry heads, all loving it. And then within 2 weeks, the Cubs won the World Series, and that's why I can call it a World, Seven Wonders of the World, because they have the World Series. But there is something staggering about I like a lot of sports, but baseball is a real thrill. And they have this thing called the double play. I'm not going to convert anybody, I know that, but nonetheless, there is the speed of thought and the athleticism and the excitement of a double play.
But what is double?
A double play. Imagine rounders, and you've got two people on the base.
Yes.
On the bases.
I can imagine baseball already.
You've got the diamond.
And
someone hits it on a ground ball to a player. They throw it to that base, and then they throw it onto that base. It sounds simple, but the twists and turns and the athleticism and the skill of it. The epic skill, which you don't see in many other sports. And cricket is sort of lumpen by comparison to what baseball gives you.
Right, okay. I don't know, you might. Well, the theory about baseball is it's impossible to swing the bat in order to hit the ball. You haven't got time to
see
where the ball...
It's 90 miles an hour and it doesn't bounce. Yes. But also there's something intriguing about it. The psychology of it is brilliant. There's something sort of stone, paper, scissors about it.
Yeah.
Where you see they sort of second guess what the player and the stats, everything's about stats, and they know, everybody knows, the catcher knows what the or the batter knows what the pitcher is likely to pitch, and they guess and they set themselves for. I think they have to set themselves. You can't follow, the eye can't work that quickly.
But it is a bit like cricket, and there's a lot not happening for a lot of the time, and people come in, and then he swings and misses.
Yeah.
And
very camp Hammond organ to sort of add atmosphere.
Yeah.
When it's all a lull. Yeah.
I think they're still using Gary Glitter, aren't they, as the music they play. They were for years.
Yeah, I don't know if
anything news has got to them yet. So, like, you want to be in my gang, yeah. This is good, wholesome American sport here. Come over here, kid. You want to be in my gang.
And at the end of the seventh innings, they sing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game." You know the old and it's the national anthem
and everything.
Yeah, the national anthem at the beginning and so forth. But no, it's the skill and the extraordinary facility they have for playing it. I think it's brilliant.
I've only been to one baseball game, and it was the Yankee Stadium in the Bronx. And we were making a documentary about how the nasty place of the Bronx, which had been for a long while, had improved. That was sort of the plot of the thing. But it was extraordinary going to the Yankee Stadium. What you could get, the fans could buy baseball bats. And just a comparison, if you went to a football match in this country and being able to buy a weapon as big as a baseball bat, you think the Bronx is tough, mate. You wouldn't have that anywhere in the UK. Has Robert converted anybody to baseball? Not really. Oh no, but it's an illustration of your interest rather than
that's it.
So you rate baseball above cricket or football.
I love Test cricket. I'm not off. I don't over the one day stuff. I'm sorry if I'm treading on any toes. So I'd rather watch baseball than the one day.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Although it's called World Series, baseball isn't really a world sport.
No, exactly. I love the chutzpah of calling their little tournament the World Series.
Yes. They claim it's because it was a newspaper that sponsored it.
Is that what it was?
Called The World. But that's been out of business for years and years.
I hadn't realised
that.
It's like
calling the Booker Prize still the Booker Prize. Yeah. Often Booker's lost interest. All right, let's go on to your third wonder, which is half man, half biscuit. Oh, there was a very slight guttural. So what sort of age do you have to be to be...
Well, he started in 85, really. His first album was called Half Man, Half Biscuit. Who are they? I mean, whenever I mention Half Man, Half Biscuit, you get to blank stares.
Yeah.
And they are a band from the Wirral. And in particular, they're led by a guy called Nigel Blackwell, who's a poet and lyricist. And... unique in the world of rock music. I mean, it's not rock. It's the definition of what he plays is sort of rock, indie, punk, folk. It's a mixture of
somebody described as punk with a sense of humour.
But the thing is, the sense of humour, that's where it gets where people misunderstand him, because music and humour, he's regarded as a novelty act. And after 35 years of hit records, the novelty's worn. I mean, that accusation has worn off as a novelty act. He is very funny, and he's also completely anti-celebrity. That's what I love about him as well. He famously turned down an opportunity in the mid-80s to appear on The Tube with Jules Holland.
Yeah.
It would have been a big break for an emerging band. He refused to go because Tranmere Rovers are playing at home.
Yes.
He is somebody who's never done an interview. He's done an interview with John Peel, he's done one with Andy Kershaw, and that's it. In the last 35 years or so, he is entirely his own person. He's never had a corporate record deal. He's always worked from Probe Records, which was a guy called Jeff in a front room in Liverpool. Jeff is now ill, so he's got his new record, The Volterol Years, which I recommend. is on a label called the RM Qualtrough label. For those of you from Liverpool, will remember that RM Qualtrough is a 1931 unsolved murder from Liverpool. It's a reference to that.
Yeah.
He's utterly unique, and every single line of an HR Half Man Half Biscuits song, which he writes, is ridden with references, wit, and the musicality is beautiful. And he's the Volterol Years is great, and he's done a serious song on the Volterol Years. About dementia, which is glorious. I mean, it's just beautiful, really beautiful. And the best before... Yes, yeah, I mean, I won't do the lyrics. But I would... Whenever I'm in a bad mood, or upset or anxious or whatever, I will put on Half My Half Biscuit very loud. And I would also sometimes... You can't often hear the lyrics on the records. But if you had the lyrics with you and Half My Half Biscuit playing... then it always improves the mood, and I just adore everything he does.
And have you been through with him through all this time?
No, I was introduced. Neil Dudgeon introduced me to him, and I was doing a play with him, and he said, "You listen to this." And the titles, okay, so the titles are gags very often.
Yeah.
Paintballs Coming Home, back in the DHSS, is one of his albums. Yeah. He did a song called I Hate Neris Hughes, which, because he just found it, not, her Liverpudlianness was wrong. But they do the Camel Laird Social Club, that was one of his songs is called The Light at the End of the Tunnel is the Light of the Oncoming Train.
Yes. Yeah.
And I was very overdressed for a Half Man Half Biscuit concert once. I was doing a play at the Bush Theatre in Shepherd's Bush. Next door, the Empire, Shepherd's Bush, he was on. We'd extended a week, so I couldn't go. And so I was playing a Tory MP. And so in my pinstripe suit, I managed to get out down the fire escape. And I had 20 minutes off in the second half, so the interval in the second half. And I was able to see some of his numbers, but rather sort of overdressed for that. But it was he's entirely unique and won't brook any praise or anything like that. I wouldn't want to meet him because but I think he's magnificent.
All right. Well, I think that's a good introduction for us into into his music or their music, because it is a band rather than just one.
Oh, funny. Yeah, they are. Neil Crossley's on the bass, and they've got Carl and thingy.
Yeah,
they got four of them. Yeah. He's the guiding thing in it, but he's
Yeah, you mentioned in passing there you played a Tory MP.
Yeah.
And you get a lot of those sort of parts, don't you? You've been a Prime Minister, an MP,
yeah.
Mark Thatcher, the son of a PM. You've done, you know, Noel Coward plays as well when you're, yeah. you tend to be the sort of Noel Cowardy role.
Yeah.
Are these parts you're comfortable in, or are you eager to play?
I like doing good writing.
Yes.
I mean, you know, do Wilde and yeah, I've done Ibsen and Chekhov and stuff like that, but Wilde and Coward are just great to do.
Yeah.
You can really chewable language. It's about language. It's about celebrating language. So
yes.
I love doing really good language.
And it's poetic.
Yeah,
and you
absolutely.
Mentioned Charles III that you played, which again that's in
yeah, that was Mike Bartlett's take on what happens when the Queen dies, and that was all in verse.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you find that easier to perform or harder to perform?
My ambition when performing verse. And I'm quite new to it, but is for the audience to leave not having been aware that constantly aware they're listening to verse.
Yeah,
is I loathe the poetry voice. I don't know if that means anything to anyone.
Yeah.
But when you have to sound like some fluting Anglican high church vicar,
I'm sure you could do that as well.
I could do that if I wanted to. Yes, but that whole poetry thing where you have to speak as though it means something.
Yeah,
and it's shut up.
Well, he did it. That same writer did poetry from Charles. He's done it's Trump, but it's something like 46th or something. It's 46 presidents, but Donald Trump is done as a sort of Shakespearean villain.
What Mike Bartlett?
Yes,
I didn't know about that.
Yeah,
right,
it's excellent. But anyway, it's nothing to do with your wonders, really. But let's we'll move along to your fourth wonder, which is, and you're doing a good range of different wonders, because your fourth wonder is the kindness of strangers.
The kindness of strangers. Well, yeah. I mean, it's a tricky one, this, but England aren't as good as they are in Scotland about it. I've noticed that I've had more grace and completely un. This, when somebody does something for you and they have no reason to do it.
Yes,
I just adore that, and we've all had experiences of that. I mean, we'd had our first child and came on holiday to Scotland and went to a cafe, and you know, we were being crap parents and just sort of the baby was sort of crying and all that. And the cafe said, give it to us, you know. And they got a girl from.
Oh wow!
I don't care. I know.
We've never had
a
child
censorious age. I like to trust people.
Yes,
okay,
yeah.
Fine. Yeah.
Even with your own firstborn.
Even with your own firstborn. Yeah, but you know, a girl from the kitchen came out, and then they took her off. And okay, yeah, I know your parenting policy should be to don't know anything. Oh, you're probably going to abuse it or whatever. Sod it. I mean, I like it when people were really.
Yes.
I have genuine kindness.
God, I hope the end of this story is a happy
it
one.
Is, it is good. My daughter was walking near Aviemore the other day on her own, and she was and someone picked her up gave her a lift, and then it just sort of she was stuck, and so put her up but there was no. I love it when people do things and there's no possible comeback for them. There's nothing in it for them.
Yes,
and I do think that Turkey, for instance, you know, you're walking in Turkey and somebody will just do an act of kindness and put you up again.
Yes.
And it's acts of kindness and grace which you come across, which take you by surprise sometimes. I think the people sort of east of Calais are better at it than we are.
Yeah.
I think Celts are better at it than the English. But by and large, the Arabs are much better at it than most of the country, most countries, because they have an ethic of hospitality.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
once you are their guest, you are their guest, and they will do it. And it's not that they want that back, you know.
No. But so if somebody you saw in trouble, you might invite them home to help them out. And if they said, "Oh, I like that," you'd give it to you. Do you feel yourself reciprocating kindness that you've had?
Well,
from
I do,
other
and
people?
I think Neil Malarkey, who you might know from the Comedy Store Players, he's for a long time he's got a thing of just taking a fiver and going here you are, to someone, and the idea being that it's a gift.
Yes,
and I think the kindness of strangers is a gift, and when it happens to you, it's not incumbent upon you, but you're more inclined to pass on that gift.
But in any city in this country, I include Scotland and England, somebody coming and giving you a fiver, you'd immediately be a bit worried.
Yeah,
what's going on?
Well,
here?
It does. It startles people, and they go like that, like that. And but he just does it for fun because he thinks that maybe they'll give the fiver on it gives him pleasure to think that they might.
Yeah.
But I mean, I just think graceless acts of kindness are just joyful when they happen to you.
All right. So this is an instructive set of wonders. So we're learning things about baseball and about poetry and about kindness to strangers. This is, you could be a vicar, I think.
I could, my child.
This is almost a sermon.
Yeah, indeed.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, your fifth wonder takes us back to, well, your performing and maybe your wider enthusiasm in poetry. Poetry is a wonder of the world.
Yeah, it's a bit of a wonder. I mean, I'm, again, slightly sort of new to this because I've been working on this show, this Love, Lost, and Candy, for quite a long time. And then my daughter, before she went off to the States, she'd been there for the last 7 years or so, she said, you've got to think about more poetry than just Christopher Reed, you know, like that.
Yes.
And so it's actually, and I wouldn't say I'm a poetry expert. There are so many people who are. But and we communicate through poetry. Mm. I never ask her how she is, because she won't tell me probably. Mm. But what I do is she got this book called The Zoo of the New. I recommend it if anybody is interested in verse in any way. The two poets Nick Laird and Don Patterson have compiled an anthology called The Zoo of the New, and they're all crackers. I mean, they're brilliant. I mean, they're all wonderful. And I just launch into, she rings, and I don't say how are you. We just launch into one of these,
all right.
And then I read it again, and then she gives me a 25-minute seminar on it. She sort of she knows her stuff.
Yes.
But it's just the pleasure of that, because, and I asked her the other day, why, what is it about these poems that are so good, and why is it? And she said they've got a sort of reverence for life, she called it.
Mm.
And I just think that's the sort of, that's what poetry can give you. And I'm not an expert, and I don't really get it first time and all that. But there's this extraordinary sort of this, the minutiae of life can be picked apart. The images can be picked apart. You can meditate on a single line.
Yes.
in good verse, not the sort of misery autobiographical verse so much. That doesn't appeal.
Yeah.
But that sort of as an introduction to things, you don't necessarily have to remember them. You don't need to have to understand them. But
yeah.
But there's a deep sort of beauty of it.
Were you taught to recite poems?
No, I was taught, I like so many people, really badly. Mm. And it was all boisterous on the burning deck stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, God. And so I left it alone for a long time. And then this, I started working with the poet Christopher Reed, and then this connection as well, which has been going on for the last 7 years, which means we sort of plunder and we sort of get I mean, I don't know if you know Billy Collins. I just jotted down a few of the ones that we've Wallace Stevens and Emily Dickinson and Edward Thomas and Robert Frost. And you just dive in. And I think if you can immerse yourself in some of these poems, you can take what you want from them.
Mm.
And there's always something vivid and something exciting and something sensual in there.
Yeah, and they're quite sort of literary figures you're playing in this play, or these two plays, so you relate to their interests, I suppose.
Well, I do. I mean, I'm very close to the Christopher Reed who wrote it.
Yeah.
And the first one is about he wrote in the aftermath, well, during his wife's illness and death. He wrote 3 years. He wrote a thing called A Scattering, which is the first of the pieces I do. I won't plug it too hard, but it's he wrote A Scattering, which is about the illness and death of his wife and some resolution. Yeah. And the second one is a farce that he wrote. He decided to write something funny, which became darker and deeper.
Well, I mentioned right at the beginning that I directed you in something, but that was in university days. So I'm older than you, but I came back to direct you in something. But then you were interested in being on the stage a bit, I thought, but you also qualified as a barrister. And then you had to, I suppose, like all actors, you have to wait until something works really well. How long do you think you had to wait until you sort of broke through?
I was still at university when you did the directing, and so I was here when I was about sort of 20, I suppose. And then, I couldn't see anyone over 33 who was still doing sketches.
No.
So I knew I wanted to act since I was 13, which I don't know why that was, but I wanted to do plays.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do what I'm doing at the moment, really, and I knew that I couldn't do just the comedy stuff, and I was doing the reviews and sketches and stuff like that.
Did you do other things at university at the time other than Footlights, which is what you were in?
Well, Footlights took up most of the time.
Yeah, but you didn't do, the Marlowe's. I'm talking about...
Yeah, I did do the Marlowe's.
Oh, you did, right.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I did. So I did a couple of plays, but mostly it was taken up with the other things. In fact, I realised my... my legal future was probably resolved in when I handed in an essay to my director of studies, who was a splendid man called James Campbell, and it was in the same week that I'd opened in Aladdin at the at the student theatre.
Yeah. And you were playing.
The conversation with James ran, and there was my piece of work. And it was a one-to-one, and he said, and he called me by my surname. It was always Bathurst, he said. Mm. He said, Bathurst, he said, this week, he said, I have seen you play the Widow Twankey, which I enjoyed. and he picked it up. He said, I have read your essay. And then he said, rather memorably, he said, what the Lord giveth with one hand. Good man.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I did go on to do the bar finals afterwards because I didn't know about drama school. I didn't know how to get into it. But I jumped after that.
Yeah.
But I did. I mean, in order to get on, I wanted to get away from doing review. I didn't want to carry on doing sketches. And my agent, I had this agent, and they wanted me to be a TV presenter.
Oh,
and
no, so I do that.
So
no,
I
awful.
Precisely. And
so you escaped being a barrister and a TV presenter.
I know.
the horrors that you had seen in others.
I know, exactly. You've led the way there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I auditioned for That's Life with Esther Ransom.
Oh, right.
And they put me my agent put me into that, and I lied my way through the auditions for That's Life, telling Esther how much I wanted to do it, and then presenting a journalistic piece and to doing it all, and then
so you'd done those conversations with her, and I spoke to the gas
there,
board, and
we did the final, and they offered it to me, and I said no, and because I knew I didn't want, I knew if I took it, I was never going to do what I'm doing at the moment. It would always be written down, and so then I took a part. At the National Theatre, holding a spear, and for 4 months, I wanted to get out of. As I say, I wanted to get out of the student world, so I took this job, holding a spear, and I had one line for 4 months in St. Joan, which was "Halt, who goes there?"
And, and did you do it a different way every night?
No,
just to show
I varied
halt,
it.
Halt, who goes there?
Right, yeah, but
halt,
I was
halt
sort
goes
of
there.
Yeah, halt, who goes there? Well, exactly, right. You can
just to show off your range of skills.
Yeah. But I was just, holding the spear at the back in my chain mail and tights and stuff like that, having turned down that side, thinking I could be opening supermarkets right now. Yeah. But I was very, and I didn't want, never want to do the other things.
So you carried on stage doing things, and the, but I'm leading to the, was Cold Feet the big sort of
I was 40 when I did Cold Feet. I
mean, 40. You don't look 40 now, Robert.
You're very kind. But it, I thought I was doing okay. I was doing lots. I'd done sitcoms, and I'd done lots of stagey stuff and and thing. I just thought I was working all right, you know, doing stuff. And then Cold Feet came along, and of course that was different. That had a huge mainstream thing about it. And so I mean, it was so late arrival in that sense.
But it's just an example of the chance nature of it.
Well, I turned down the recall for it. I turned down the audition for it.
Because
I was doing theatre.
Yes, was coming back again.
I was doing theatre, and it was the tech run, and I couldn't leave the theatre. If I'd known that the show, well, that's that job would last for 22 years, the theatre wouldn't have seen me for dust. Yeah. Really, I'd have.
Yeah. Yes, which you don't know, but the success of a TV programme depends on so many things, like a film does as well. But if you're not in one of those successes, you can carry on getting no notice at all.
It's there's a really good line in Love, Lost and Chianti about theatre being a ramshackle, blindly trundling machine with bits falling off it. It clatters through the generations, more wasteful of lives than a losing army.
Yes.
And it's like that. Yeah, yeah.
Well done. Anyway, Cold Feet comes along, and does that? Do you then know? All right. Well, I've got a big enough name and well enough known name that I can at least be considered for an awful lot of parts as they come along.
Yeah, no. I mean, it was different. I mean, it created a lot of. I mean, it was huge. And what was great about Cold Feet was they never optioned us. We never knew we were going to do another series. No. Every series was the last. Mm. And we did 4-5 series back in the day, and then 13 years off. And every week in that 13 years, people were saying, is it coming back? Is it coming back?
Yeah.
And you think, no, it's of its time. And then it did come back. And we did another 4 series of
that. And were you always worried when you got the script for the next one, you know, your part? Is it a car crash?
It's like that Tony Hancock episode when he finds he's been written out. Actually, the Cold Feet scripts, it was interesting because when they used to flop through the letterbox in those days. And I used to just read them. And if they were, I mean, sometimes you think your fingers tingle. It was just really exciting when you think, oh, well, I'm looking forward to doing this.
Or you're flicking through and say, where's he coming? Oh, he goes out again.
I know.
He goes on holiday to Mallorca. Yes. When's he coming back, for God's sake? Have you been written out like in things before, dying early
I've
on?
I've been killed in the first episodes of Red Dwarf and Hornblower.
Oh, right.
I got turned into a pile of sherbet in the first episode of Red Dwarf.
Yes.
They did ask me back. I was in Manchester doing Cold Feet, and they asked me back to resurrect the character for an episode. And I'd love to have done that, but I couldn't. And Hornblower, I got blown up. It was just before we started the first series of Cold Feet. So I was sort of lying. I was lying, doing. So Johan Griffiths was sort of over there, and it was a sort of, you know, you go ahead and do Hornblower. I'll go off and do Cold Feet.
Yes.
So,
you know.
But
it's never done Sean Bean any harm. He often dies in things, doesn't he?
But he
comes back on again.
I think people, actors are divided between those who hit and those who get hit.
Yes.
And I had a little thing on my website. I had that website which disappeared somewhere, but I mean, it was a thing called Greatest Hits of me being punched and kicked and killed and blown up in various things over the years.
Do you ever get hurt doing that? If they accidentally hit you?
Well, Sean Pertwee bloody nearly.
Sean Pertwee
split my brow in Cold Feet. We had a fight in a flat in Sydney when we did an episode in Sydney, and he gave me a headbutt.
Yes.
And he claimed it was meant, but I could feel his eyebrow kiss mine, and it was just and he said it was skill on his part. My buddy wasn't telling it.
Well, rather Sean Pertwee than Sean Bean hitting you, I'd say.
Yeah.
But anyway, so jolly good. I can't remember what that was poetry. I don't know how we got to you being hit in poetry. Yeah. But so your sixth wonder is jump racing, which is another slight surprise. I didn't know you had an interest in. I assume this is horse racing over jumps.
Right? Yeah, as opposed to on the flat.
Yes, yes. Okay.
Yeah.
No, I understand that. But
as in jump racing.
Yes, jump racing. Okay, fair enough. Yeah, all right.
Yeah. I came to this through the writing, actually. I came through it through language, again. Alistair Down in the Racing Post. And I love the double speak that that all trainers and jockeys employ.
Yeah.
Which and the subtext of everything they say is it wasn't my fault.
Yes.
And I love the smell of horses. I've always loved the smell of horses. I could never ride one, but I like being around them. And I love the sport because it's not scientific. You can't really judge who's going to win. Chance plays a major part. And I love the sport as well because it's pure sport in the sense that if you're a champion in that sport, you've got to reckon on losing 80% of the time. And try telling that to Alex Ferguson.
Yes.
You
know? Yeah.
And so if you have to be really good at losing.
Yeah.
And you know, you're able to ride with the disappointment.
Yeah.
And I also think it's thrilling. I directed a film about jockeys last year.
Oh, right.
Called The Fall. Which we co-wrote with an ex-jockey called Nathan Horace. Two jockeys committed suicide about a couple of years ago, and James Banks and Liam Treadwell. And he wanted to write something about the particular pressure that jockeys are under, being the most exposed of all athletes, really, in some ways. They don't have a support group. They've left school at 15. They're working their way through a yard. They're disposable, easily sacked.
They travel around a lot as well.
And they travel 60,000 miles a year, often in despair, having had a bad day and injured, and always trying to lose weight. And also now with the social media pylon coming at them as they go. So the film was about that. It was just a short drama.
All right.
But I would happily all winter go to National Hemp Racing every day. I love it. Yeah.
So it's not just going to your local bookies and putting on. It's not just the betting.
The betting doesn't interest me that much. I like being right. Everybody likes being right, but I don't need to be right for and put 20, you know, try and put a fiver on and be just as happy and putting a 50 on. I just adore it.
I see some people. Not, I don't see anybody here thinking this. But I think, well, but isn't jump racing a bit harsh on the
horses?
Yeah, that's
an argument.
Fall over a bit and break their legs and
all
they have
sport,
to be put down. The jockeys get injured, as you said, as well. But they're in a sense, volunteers.
You can argue that. And, they're bred to jump, and it's dangerous and it's brutal.
Do you think the horses enjoy it? Do you think?
Well, when the horse ships their jockey, they run around. They're pack animals. Yeah. They run around with all the other animals jumping over the jumps as well.
I always ask people in horse races: do the horses know they're in a race?
No, absolutely. I mean, if you've ever been pony trekking, sometimes there's always a horse that has to be in the lead.
Yes.
You know, there's always one that does bloody hell. You won't be worsted, and will always.
I always end up with the one that wants to eat the whole.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. He's just dagging up. Yeah.
That comes later, mate. Okay. You're at work now.
Well, they generally don't do racing. Yeah,
no, yeah. They've been found wanting. Yeah. So you directing jockeys, because you're quite a tall person. You must have been sort of looking down on them.
I wasn't directing jockeys. So it was really good. We had Daniel Thrace played the jockey. He's not a rider, but he looks like one. And he has that sort of gimlet eyed, that far away, that thousand-yard stare that jockeys have.
Yeah.
And what we did, actually, we Ascot Racecourse gave us the weighing room to film in for a couple of scenes.
Right.
And a lot of jockeys who knew the guys who died came in and just were our extras. And it was an unspoken, really sort of very moving thing for them to do.
All right.
Daniel and Chloe Wade was the other actor in it.
Right. Well, that's a very good wonder, if I may say so, because you've kind of acted on it. You have gone forward with your wonder and done something about it. We've come to your last wonder, though, which is another surprise. I think I didn't think I'd have anyone putting this wonder on there, and there have been surprisingly few overlaps. Yeah. But seven is prisons.
Yes.
Now, why on earth would you regard prisons as a wonder of the world? Of all the things in the world, all the nice things, the pleasant things, the inspiring things, a place where people are locked up in miserable conditions for having done, or sometimes not even having done, some dreadful thing. Yeah. Why do you think wonders? Yeah. Why do you think prisons are a wonder of the world? Yeah.
Well, the current prison system is about 200 years old, and the wonder is how we could have fucked it up. I mean, how can we have a system which has a 50% reoffending rate?
Mm.
I mean, we spend 40,000 a year on a prisoner in there, and it's costing us a lot. surely we can find a system that actually works.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, you've got to keep people out and you've got to keep people safe and away from society and give have some sort of level of punishment. I don't know what the Norwegian system is or the Dutch system. I gather the Dutch system is you are sentenced to 3 years in prison. When can you make it? I'm not quite sure if that's true or not. But we have a system which does not work. Mm-hmm. And I got friends who do... They battle very hard to try and they go into prisons and one does an outfit called Liberty Choir and they get some support from the Home Office and the prisoners, but not really. I mean, they do. They'd be upset to hear that, but they do. And they go in and they do they take prisoners in the last few years of their sentence and outsiders come in and they sing with them. And then they get attached. Then they get links with community choirs. You know, the whole thing is just to try and make prisons sort of work. Try and get people out and actually get them operating. There's another outfit called Fine Cell Work who do embroidery. And they're just brilliant. I mean, they both I checked today actually with the people who do that. And independently, I said, how many of your sort of graduates, as it were, sort of people who come through your system, how many of them are statistically likely to reoffend? And it's a very difficult thing to assess. But and of the studies that have been done on both Fine Cell Work and Liberty Choir, it's about 2% of reoffending in the 2 years. So people have been through their system. So it's an indication that there is a possibility of finding something. I mean, I went round when I was a law student, I went round Wormwood Scrubs with my landlady who was had visit prison. She had access all areas. Yeah. And, you know, I stood next to Ian Brady and she was trying to tell him how he wasn't allowed to have certain books on S&M that he was ordering and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And he was in the hospital wing because he couldn't be, he had to be kept away from everybody else.
Yes.
I got an atmosphere of, well, in the lifers wing and you, maybe people are in for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, but you realise that the prison officers, they're in that atmosphere for their entire career.
Yeah.
You know, and no wonder the atmosphere, things get skewed.
Mm.
And so, the wonder is, how can we have mucked it up?
Well, that's an interesting use of the word wonder, but that's...
I'm wondering,
there's an alternative system. We could go back to, in the old days, people weren't sent to prison. They were kept in a cell for a while, then brought in front of the judge, and they were either then executed or they were let go because it turned out it was all right.
Well, you've probably sent a few people to prison, haven't you?
I've never been a judge, but...
A barrister, haven't you?
I did do a lot of crime, and I prosecuted and defended.
Yeah.
But as chance would have it, everybody I defended was innocent. And... I visited prisons, obviously to go into. I tried to avoid it because I didn't like having conferences with clients because sometimes it muddied the water of how the defence is going to develop. But they're hideous.
They remember their lines.
Yeah, they say what they have to say, but they are unpleasant places, especially the sort of the ones you tend to go to if you're going to see a trial coming up. So you mentioned Wormwood Scrubs. Yeah. These are all London prisons. Holloway, which is closed now, which was a woman's prison, was particularly unpleasant.
Yes.
And Pentonville, which is possibly even worse, but they were going to close, but as a cost-cutting exercise, they're keeping it open still. Some of the open prisons...
Forward and places like that.
Yeah, they're people, a bit better. They're they're vaguely of this century. Right? As you say, some of these prisons were built for a cell for, you know, one man, usually, who's come from rather rough conditions in the Victorian age, could just about cope with that cell. Yeah. Now, people are used to rather better conditions outside of the prison, and there may be three of them in the cell, so it's got considerably worse. So it's either go back to executing them or sending them to Australia
you've got to do something, and you're not being too lily-livered about it, but I mean, it's sort of but what you learn in prison and what you come out with. Why are we spending all that money doing this when we've got to find something some other way?
Part of the problem is that there's a certain amount of money being spent, and if somebody says, well, let's spend some more money, half the people say, oh, why are you spending money on prisoners when there's hospitals? And the other half say, don't build, put more money, because you'll just expand the prison. You'll start sending more people to prison. So you can have completely opposite points of view and keep things the way they are.
They are the sump of society, you know. But just to say, you know, get on with it.
Well, there's another charity you might be interested in. I think it's called Kestrel, which encourages or puts on plays with prisoners. And I've met some of them because I've done a couple of events with. They come on to sort of. Not perform, but sort of talk to the people that are being money is being extracted from legally, you know, to fundraising. And the great thing about that is, I said, well, just tell me what they've all done. And I said, well, but you mustn't mention it. You don't want to say to the crowd at any point, you know, this guy did, you know, swapped a tax sticks round, and this one killed somebody. Just everyone has to be just, you know, kept okay, you know, to the same level.
My landlady who took me to Wormer Scrubs, then we went back to the Scrubs and saw whodunit.
Yes.
Done by the prisoners.
Yeah. And I'm not saying.
And it was, but it was, that was the third night. But the second night, the second night had been cancelled because of a siege in B Wing.
But this is a very interesting landlady you have that take you
to prison. Yeah, she was great.
Prison. Yeah. Okay, look, Robert, it's been great to see you again and to hear a little bit about your play, but also a lot more about your interests and life. I think I've got to know you better over this hour than I have over the last 40 years, but that probably says something about me rather than anything else. Robert Bathurst, thank you for sharing your seven wonders with me. I now have to choose the wonder of wonders from your list of seven, the one which struck me as particularly wonderful as you described it in this podcast. And this is quite difficult, actually. I'm not sure I'm quite brave enough to make prisons the wonder of wonders. I was impressed by what you said about half man, half biscuit, but I think I better wait until I've actually listened to a bit more of... I think it's hard to beat the kindness of strangers as a wonder of the world. You can either say, yeah, it is a wonder because it never happens, or yes, it is a wonderful thing, and what a good thing to be selected. So thank you very much. Can we give a round of applause to Robert Bathurst?
If you enjoyed this episode of My Seven Wonders, it would be wonderful if you could rate and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you found us. Thank you for listening.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.